Hello, everyone. I'm Bruce Devereaux, and welcome to The Creatively Engaging, a podcast about the changemakers and storytellers who are reshaping how we view aging in our communities. My guest today on the show will be Chandra. Today's episode requires a bit of backstory, though, before I launch into the interview with Chandra. It goes back to the year 2011. I was approached by the curator of our local museum, the Sunshine Coast Museum and Archives. Maynard Cassa, a gentleman in his mid-80s, had contacted them, wondering if he could get somebody to help him record his life story for his family. And upon meeting Maynard, I became instantly enamored with his passion and his storytelling charm. Our afternoon of recording was a treat because the stories were fascinating. Pioneer child in the great north of Canada with wild horses, wild animals, and two pet bears.
At about a month and a half, we got them to start eating porridge, and they sure started to grow then. It wasn't long before we had to start feeding them in separate bowls, because whenever one was finished first, he would go over to the other one's bowl, and then a fight would start. They would really go at it, rolling all over the ground and even through the porridge. Then they would finally stop fighting. They'd get to finish eating, then get together and clean each other off as if nothing had ever happened. It was a sight to see sometimes.
When we finished the recording session, Maynard commented on the collection of 8mm home movies and projectors in my studio space. "I see you like old films," he said. "Yes, especially the older home movies, Maynard." "I have a bunch of films," Maynard replied. "They were my dad's. You should come by and check them out sometime." "That'd be great. I'd love to, Maynard." So in the moment, the significance of Maynard's statement didn't really sink in. Here was a man in his mid to late 80s commenting that he had a bunch of his father's films. About 2 weeks later, my phone rang. It was Maynard, and he'd like me to come by and have a look at the films. We agreed to the next Saturday and wished each other well, and we'll see you then. So in reflection for me, this was a powerful life lesson moment. When a door opens, don't ignore it. Walk through it. So when Saturday arrived, I found myself walking through that door into Maynard's apartment, expecting to find maybe a few average 8mm home movies. Maynard pointed to the spare bedroom. When he flicked the light switch, he not only turned on the lights, but he simultaneously took my breath away. Piled on the floor, surrounded by vintage projectors, cameras, and editing equipment, was about 15,000 feet of 16mm film. I was stunned. "Who was your father?" I asked. "He was John Cassa, just an average guy that used to travel on his own in the wilds of Canada during the 1940s and 50s and 60s to film with his 16mm Bolex camera. His journeys would see him gone for significant periods of time, and then he would spend months editing the film in the kitchen of our house. Once finished, he would hit the road with the films and tour them around the U.S. and Canada, entertaining crowds with his adventure stories in the wilds of Canada." Maynard suggested that I take the films and the projector and have a look at them. I did, and when I set up the equipment at home and I fired up that vintage 16mm projector, it felt a little bit like I was starting an old train locomotive. The thing was a beast. As the films started to roll through the projector gate, I quickly realized I was looking at something very, very special. These needed to be transferred to high-quality digital before anything happened to them, I thought. So the next 2 years would see Maynard and I getting the films transferred in increments to help spread out the cost and not risk all the films being damaged or lost in one shot. It was interesting because near the end of the transferring process, Maynard would frequently ask, "So what are we going to do with all this digital stuff?" Honestly, at the time, I didn't know. But the first step was building a website to display the films. Short of that, well, I'm sure Maynard was thinking, what have I gotten myself into with this guy? Then about 6 months after the final footage was transferred, I received an email from an independent film blog that I followed. I was just about to hit the delete button when I noticed a small two-line request at the bottom of the email. Independent filmmaker in Los Angeles seeking archival footage for upcoming documentary Beyond the Bolex. Footage shot with the Bolex. Please contact Alyssa Bosley. I quickly fired off an email to Alyssa, and her response was fast. That evening, we were chatting about how we could use Maynard's footage in the film. I sent Alyssa some samples to share with her team, and I believe this was on a Tuesday. Later that week, on Thursday, I was registered to attend a workshop being held at the museum, the same one where I first met Maynard several years earlier. How to host a microfilm festival was the topic. I was thinking that one day we could host a microfestival to share Maynard's films with the community. When Thursday arrived, I must admit I wasn't feeling energized to attend, and while laying on my living room floor post-work, I mentioned to my wife, Makiko, that I had registered us for the workshop. The session was interesting, but I quickly realized the logistics involved in hosting a microfestival wouldn't fit how we envisioned sharing Maynard's films. Those in attendance, a total of probably about five, including Makiko and I, were all probably feeling the same way. I definitely was ready to get home. Then another door opened. At the end of the workshop, the presenter pointed to the woman sitting directly behind me and said, "Shendra, with her documentary films." I spun around and asked, "Films? What kind of camera did you use?" "Well, actually, they were my husband's films, and he used a 16mm Bolex. He was very prolific and diverse in his filmmaking. Probably the most significant, though, would be the first recorded footage of Lacandon Maya in Mexico. A peoples of whom little was known at the time, except that they had escaped the Spanish invasion and the diseases of the old world by disappearing into the great rainforest, there to live a symbiotic relationship with it and to survive for over 400 years. I excitedly told her about Maynard's films and that I have a call with the crew in Los Angeles tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. I then asked Shendra, is there anything that she had that I could send and share with the crew in Los Angeles? I'm sure that during that 40-minute drive home, Shendra's head was spinning with ideas. Because the next morning, when I received the first images from her films, I was in awe of their beauty. I also noticed that she had sent the email at 4 a.m. Obviously, she spent the night pulling all these materials together. It wasn't long after I forwarded Shendra's images to Alyssa in L.A., the phone rang. The first words I heard upon answering with an amazed chuckle were, "Who are you people?" That was the start of a magical journey and many beautiful friendships. Welcome again to the Creatively Engaging. Yeah, and you know, it was really interesting when I was recording that intro for the podcast, but I couldn't stop thinking about what an amazing experience that was, right? It was just the synchronicity.
It was just serendipitous, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was. It was truly amazing. So how did it feel for you listening to that intro, like a couple of years after, many years after?
Well, yeah, what it did was sort of trigger the good feelings that both Maynard and I had to be doing this. And we didn't care whether Alyssa used our footage or anything. We're all re-enthused about the memory of the original filming. And for Maynard, it was traveling with his dad and the Bolex falling into the river and all this. And for me, it was Colin in the jungle. And I was so excited. So when you said, you know, you wanted footage, I didn't think to say, "Oh, no, I don't do that sort of thing." I couldn't wait to get home, and I was so excited, Bruce. I have to tell you, I used up so much nervous energy. I was sick for a week, I was ill for a week. I was wiped out because I was so excited to be tuned in. And I think Maynard and I, we remained that way. When Alyssa came to film, it was the same thing. I was so excited, I used up all my nervous energy.
Before the Beyond the Bolex came into the picture and before it connected our paths, how were you thinking about showing Colin's films or his work? Did you have any plans around those?
And so basically I was thinking of television. Locally, the local television, they were going to do a series of little blurbs from each of Colin's films. Yes, it was mainly television I was thinking of. But then that's when I came to the workshop because I thought, well, maybe I could do a little film festival up here showing Colin's films. That's why I went to that gathering.
And you almost didn't go to that workshop? Is that what I remember correctly?
No, it's right. It was in Gibson's. It wasn't until 7 at night. I had the long drive home in the dark, and I thought, oh, I don't want to do it. But something in me said, you've got to go. And I visited with a friend in Roberts Creek, and I said, you know, it was 4 o'clock, and I'd visited for tea. And I said, you know, there's this film discussion going on. There's a film festival. I said, you know, it's really late. I don't want to go yet. I think I have to go. So my friend Rose said, well, for heaven's sake, stay here, have dinner with me, and then go. So the whole time, I was half there and half not there, Bruce. And so when you turned and said, did he use a Bolex? I said, well, yeah, and a Leica and a Rolly. And then you said, I need footage by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning for this film company in Los Angeles. And I thought, oh my God. So all the way home, I just, as you said in your introduction, I was just thinking, footage. Finally, I think I sent you all the portraits.
Yes,
didn't
you did.
I?
Yeah. I don't think I saw any actual film footage that time, but I think the stills and the photos.
Yeah, that's what I finally ended up with. I was desperately trying to make a little film to send you. That's what took all night. And then I thought, no, I'll just send the portraits. They always sell the story.
And they were stunning. There was no doubt about that.
Those portraits have opened the door. Absolutely, they opened the door wherever I went. I'd love to bring in the fact that on top of our getting together for April's presentation, that I was in touch with you because there was this film on asbestos being given at the Gibson's Arts Center, and I really felt we had to go, and I didn't know why.
Yes,
but I said to you, please, let's go, and we did. And you're telling the filmmaker on the asbestos film about Beyond the Bolex film, and she said, oh, There's a chap in Barrie, Ontario, who teaches 16mm Bolex, and he has it all over his grounds, and his students write on the films. And so it just happened that Alyssa's crew was in Barrie and could go and get some footage. So here was another serendipitous thing.
Well, that was funny at the point, because I think we were at that point in our relationships where we were saying, Bruce, I think we need to go to this workshop or film, or Shendra, yeah, I think we need to go to this workshop or film, yeah, that we didn't question it, even if it was about pink unicorns. We figured probably there would be some kind of connection somewhere. and the asbestos, and I thought, oh my gosh, she's asking me to go to a film on asbestos, but it was a fascinating film.
It was.
I ended up knowing the people involved in it. Mm-hmm. And like you said, the director knew the person that ran a 16mm film farm camp back in Ontario, yeah, that Alyssa and Camillo had the chance to attend, and actually made it in the final film.
It's just wonderful. The whole thing was meant to be. It had to be.
Now, Shendra, even by today's standards, Colin and Arthur's 1960 road trip from Vancouver, Canada, to the southern border of Mexico is an epic journey. How did they do it?
They had a Cadillac, and the Cadillac, they put a false roof on it, and they put in 10,000 feet of 16mm film. because they would never be allowed to carry any that much film over the border. And so they traveled down to by car. They went by car to San Cristobal de las Casas in southern Chiapas. And they went to the Nabalom, which was the cultural center for the Lacandon, and where this was a safe house for the Lacandon because the peasants of the area were very suspicious of the Lacandon because they were different, you know, they had long shifts and things. And so they had to have a safe house when they came to San Cristobal. Dr. Franz Blom and his wife, Trudy de Blom, they took them in, and they were always allowed free. They could stay for free at this place, but it was also a guest house for tourists if they wanted to stay. And so Colin and Arthur made Nabalom their base, and they loaded all, they packed for the jungle there. And at the last moment, Trudy said, "Well, I'm coming with you." She was supposed to go back to Mexico City because she was giving a photographic exhibition, but she said no. She couldn't wait to get back to the jungle. She actually had her own little hut near the Lacandon village. And that was called Trudy's hut, you know. She was the one that stayed there. So they drove to Comitán, which is a few miles north of San Cristobal, and they flew into the edge of the jungle to a ranch. And at the ranch, they hired horses and burros and guides through the jungle to get to Lake Najar. The pilot who flew them to the edge of the jungle said he would be back in 3 weeks, and they had to be there to be flown out, otherwise they wouldn't get out. So they had 3 weeks in the jungle to do their filming.
I remember you were telling me also that they had some time when they were down in the jungle, and that Arthur and Colin went walking and they found a Mayan temple, and there was something, a unique discovery.
Yes, you know what? And Dr. Blom, Franz Blom, Don Pancho said, "No, there's nothing there. There's nothing there." But Colin declared a day off for everybody. And he and Arthur just took this jungle, followed animal trails, and they marked trees so they could get back to the camp. And they walked several hours, and they came to this deserted village. And at first they thought it was a trap. And always the Maya, when they had a ruin or whatever, there was always a stream. There was always a flat area for huts and things and for growing veggies. And then there was a mountainous thing that they were sure was probably a Maya ruin that had been taken over by the jungle. And they went into these huts, and the dishes were on the table, as though they suddenly disappeared. Strange, they felt really peculiar. And in one of the buildings there, Arthur found a little violin, like somebody had tried to make a violin. So he took it out with him. And when I was talking with him, because we were planning this going back to film the sequel, I said, do you still have that little violin? And he said, no. He said, it didn't stand up to being, you know, handled, and it didn't stand up. It was just a little makeshift. Somebody had tried to make a violin. So they figured, they wondered if there had been a big a hurricane or a tornado or a big storm over Mexico in the just before the 60s. And they're wondering if the people got panicked and just left and never came back, just left things.
Wow. In the movie, Mateo and his song, what is the story behind that song or the recording?
Mateo's prayer. Each of the Maya had a god house separate from their living quarters in which they prayed. And they would pray, well, for health, for the forest, for game, or if they prayed for the family, if one of the members of the family was ill. And the Mateo's prayer that you hear on the recording, Colin asked Trudy what it was for. And she said, Mateo was praying for the pain in his knee to be relieved.
This take was a prayer to the forest gods to cure rheumatism.
And when he went into the guardhouse, he was limping, and when he came out, he was walking normally.
I remember looking at when the burros are going through the jungle, I noticed that Arthur has his arm in a sling.
Oh, yes, I should have told you. On the way to the, as they drove through to San Cristobal, they stopped at this sort of roadside space and set up their tent. And Arthur went to throw some garbage over the cliff. And when he didn't come back, it was dark, Colin went looking for him, and he had thrown himself over the cliff with the garbage. And he had only a little stunted tree stopped him from going all the way to the bottom and killing himself. And Colin was able to haul him up, and he had broken his wrist. And here he was, a violinist, and it was his fingering wrist, his left wrist. And he was one of these people that swelled a lot. Well, Colin had, he's an industrial first aider. So he gave Arthur a big slug of whiskey and set the wrist. But he set it in such a way that every day he loosened the splints and had Arthur move his fingers. And that's really all that saved his career as a violinist. He was a brilliant young violinist. He was a savant violinist from the time he was four. So this was huge that he broke his wrist. But because Colin did that, this gave him his fingering. It kept everything supple.
Was Arthur able to continue playing later, have a career?
He did. He did. When they got back from the jungle, Arthur actually became the concertmaster with the Winnipeg Symphony for many, many years. And I think that choice, rather than do his professional solo work, was because of the injury. And then he came back to Vancouver and was the concertmaster for the Vancouver Opera and also the youth orchestra. He was the conductor for the youth orchestra. And he trained them so well, Bruce, that at one point, they were giving a performance in the Queenie Theatre, and there was a power outage. And that orchestra did not miss a beat. They played right through the outage until they got the lights going again, and without a flaw. And the audience just erupted with praise for them. And for Arthur, those kids knew their work so well. And there was a lady in the audience who was so impressed that she changed her will the very next day to leave a huge amount of a bequest to the Youth Symphony Orchestra. And 2 weeks later, she passed away. So talk about serendipity and timing. It's a little reminds me of the beginning of the Bolex project that took on a life of its own, yeah.
In Colin's words, "My cameras became the motivating force of all my ventures. They clung to me on the highest mountain peaks, followed me through rapids, sailed with me in howling gales, and even learned to dive below the sea." Colin recorded with an artist's eye the heart of all that each adventure revealed.
Well, he was brilliant, of course. He was highly intelligent. He was really into chemistry. And he had a chem lab at his home, a chemistry lab. Colin's home was on Woodstock Avenue in Vancouver. And they had, out of the kitchen, they had a sort of a little sunroom, and they used to keep a macaw parrot out there in his cage. And Colin had his lab out there, and he played with things like nitroglycerin. He was so comfortable with it because he knew if the nitro was soaked in water, it couldn't explode. So it was in his lab. Well, his dad was the foreman of the BC Sugar and very proud of Colin. And he brought the chief chemist back to his home to see Colin's lab. The chief chemist took one look at the nitroglycerin and said, "God, they could break the whole street down. Get it out of here." So Colin came home and he was fired. He had to close that lab down. So he was fired down to the basement of the house, and he turned his chemistry lab into a dark room and put all of his chemistry wisdom into photography. And he was brilliant. He never did it for, he would not do it for money. He was the first person to perfect color separation technique in the West. And I wished I'd recorded him explaining how it worked, but he developed it and used it, and he got to be known, and people would say, "Please, would you do this color thing for me?" And then they began to pressure him for time, and he stopped right away. He would not destroy the perfection of the work to rush it. He wouldn't do it, and he wouldn't teach anybody else how to do it. He just did it because that's what he was doing. And he even invented something, some procedure during the developing process that somebody said, "You know, that's very valuable. You should talk to Kodak about that." And Colin wasn't interested in that. And later, Kodak did get that, whatever it was, they used it. And so Colin missed a lot of chances to make a lot of money if that were his aim, but it wasn't. It was just loving what he was doing.
How do you think Colin would feel seeing his pictures and film on the screen, and to know that now, all these years later, they're still being talked about, they're still being viewed?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Colin was very shy about sharing the, it was so precious to him, Bruce. We have to understand that he thought these people were more advanced than civilization because they lived in harmony. They shared. They were there for each other. And he thought that was a brilliant way to live. And so he sort of nurtured that within himself and thought of them always as never changing. So when the changes came, I realized, he said, no, that's not happened. The forests haven't come down. And I thought, oh, I can't say anything while he's still living. So in the 1980s, in the late 1980s, when the forests came down, he didn't want to know that. He didn't want to think that their way of life had been destroyed. And so that was so hard for him. So, I mean, they were so cheated. I mean, people gave them money. They didn't know what money was for. They didn't need money. But then their jungle had been destroyed when 400 mahoganies came down around the village. They had to move away from the village. It was disease and flooding and the absolute desecration in the jungle where the original village was. So I think maybe at this stage, knowing that now they still have their unique village, I think he would be glad to know that they had survived.
Would you say that this was probably the one that he looked at as the best that he had made and the most influential?
Colin, overall, that was the highlight of his filming career. Yeah, he found the people so beautiful, who lived so simply in harmony. He said, "I never heard a child cry." Everyone worked together. That's what he loved. Everyone worked together. Everybody shared. And he said he couldn't think of a better way of life. And he came out with that real reverence for their way of life.
What year did Colin pass away?
97. He passed away a month after the spiritual leader of the Lacandon Don, who passed away in December, late December, and they said he lived to be 106. And Colin passed away in late January.
From 97 to the year 2000, that's a period.
Nothing much happened except I did a lot of crashing. So there was, for 3 years, I was just sort of spinning my wheels. We'd been together a long time, and it was like losing part of me. It was very traumatic. When the ambulance brought me back to the cottage, having left Colin in Seashelt, which I stood outside the door and thought, I don't want to go in there. I don't know whether I can live here. I don't know. And I opened the door, and this is truly it. And it was freezing. We had a wood fire, and it had been out. It was freezing, but it was warm. It was dark, but it was light. And Colin's energy was zinging there. I could feel him saying, hey, hey. He was trying to tell me what it was like. He was fine. He was trying to tell me he was okay. And I couldn't quite accept that. And then for the next week, it was as though he'd gone on holiday and he was going to come back. So I did all the things like getting his extra oxygen things back to the clinic, and as though, yes, you know, he was fine now. And so it didn't hit me for a couple of weeks. And then I went into the deep depression. Oh, boy, it's real. It's really, he's really gone. But I'll never forget the feeling coming into the cottage. I knew I could live here. I knew I could carry on. So that was pretty profound.
He was there. His energy was there for you.
Oh, absolutely. And he was trying to tell me he was fine, which is the story, by the way, that keeps coming back.
Shender, just hearing the way that you talk about the experiences, it seems that you were very determined to return to the Lacandon village to connect with the people and bring Colin's work forward.
I had traveled down to Naha in 2002 to ask permission for Arthur and I to come back to film. And so I did that on my own. I went in with an anthropologist who explained that I had everything in halting Spanish to explain to them, and we got permission to do it, but we couldn't. But then Arthur died before we could get back. So everything sort of went into flux. We couldn't, you know, I couldn't move forward.
So another setback, but what made you pursue going to the Lacandon village?
One evening, I happened to turn on Knowledge Network to a documentary already in progress, and there were Colin's people. Well, there was Chanquin Viejo, there was the spiritual leader. I thought, oh my God, and I threw a VHS into the machine and recorded what I could. I thought, they're still alive. They're still alive. I have to go back and bring it full circle. So that became my goal. You know, and I kept dropping the ball when, you know, I kept dropping the ball and dropped opportunities, but it was meant to be but it wasn't gelling until I went to this workshop and Hilary Pryor came to me. I have my armload of portraits with me, and she said, I want to do this film. And so she took the ball from there, and it didn't happen right away. It took maybe another year, and there was another gathering, and we met the History Channel producer, who was the guy, who was the fellow who was going to say, yes, we'll do this. And yes, he said, yes, we would do it. And yeah, so that was very exciting. But when you're working with a film crew, you know, and someone else is really organizing it and is the director and all that, I went along with it. I was just so thrilled to be doing it even. And Hilary said to me, when we get there, just ignore us. We'll do the filming. You just be your normal self.
One of the things that impressed me the most when you were sharing the photos, the film, the audio sound recordings, was the sounds of the jungle. Can you tell me a little bit about that, how that experience was for you when you would hear that?
Oh, God. When I hear the jungle sounds, I am transported back to the rainforest, which is away from the village. And I was in a little area, which was actually where Trudy's campsite, that was on the edge of the jungle and the edge of the lake also. And I was so excited to be there. I thought, oh my gosh, he had a hammock and I had a tent in Trudy's campsite. I was snugged in my hammock, in my sleeping bag, and the forest began to breathe. And Colin had told me about the nighttime floods, the flooding. I can't tell you how that rain pounded. If we hadn't had a roof over our heads, we would have about been drowned. It was just an incredible flooding, hours and hours of it. And in the morning, the sun came up and the mist came off. The sun was brilliantly hot early. And all this mist went up and the birds woke up and the jungle sounds, the monkeys, the parrots, just amazing. There was one that woof woof. There was one sound that kept coming up. Woof woof. And that would be monkeys, then as I lay in my hammock, some of the lacandon came down to the lake, and I could hear them walking through just quietly on the lake. And the other magical thing was actually when Irene and I were on the Kayoko on the lake. And it was, I can't tell you, the feeling of peace.
Take one, jungle sounds.
Magical. It was just something you'd have to experience to believe. Colin, you know, was very shy about once he'd finished his touring with the film in BC after he got it edited. He would bring people into his workshop here, his editing room, and show them his portraits. He was very low key about it. And he wanted to sort of hold it within himself because it was so special to him. I think given the givens, he was thrilled that it was brought full circle and that it was completed. And I always, you know, Bruce, I could never have done it for me. I did it for Colin because I was so sincerely knowing that's what I had to do, regardless of how long it took. I was going to do this completion of the story. And when I showed it in Madeira Park in the community hall, afterwards they said, well, Chandra, I said, you know, it was for Colin's. I did this for Colin. They said, no, Chandra, this is your film with Colin's highlights. And I couldn't have done it for me ever. I can only do things for other people. So, but they saw it as my film, and I never saw it as my film. And yet, I guess it was if I were in charge of bringing it full circle, but that wasn't my intention. But at the same time, realizing that, you know, we're stewards of the moment. And so everything we do is there in the record, as it were. We can recreate and we can move on with things. I think we help move things forward. You know, the ancestors move forward. Yeah, it was a completion. It had to be, it was a completion. And I think maybe, Bruce, this is what life, we're meant to let go and move on.
While planning the original concept for this episode, I viewed it as a story of synchronicity and adventure. As the episode was developing, I realized it was something more. It was a love story. A love for a foreign land, for an indigenous people, and the love between Chandra and Colin. a powerful bond that fueled their creative lives while together and continues to this day holding them spiritually. With this in mind, I wondered how I could complete this episode's amazing story. I felt that it was missing something. Going back through our interview recordings, I found a thread. Chandra, in casual conversation, mentioned a letter. I didn't pick up on it at the time, so I decided to give her a call to explore it more. It was the thread that I was looking for. In the year 2000, she had made an inspired pledge to Colin that she would bring his work full circle, the work that he had started with the Lacedaemonian Maya.
January 27th, 2000, 1:27 a.m., Covenant for the New Millennium. 3 years ago, and 3 hours from now, Colin passed to another level of awareness, yet very much still in this dimension. I cannot reach through the veils to touch Colin now. I had 38 years to do that, and did. But Colin is present in every frame of film and in all the negatives and the Maya portraits which preside over this space. All are kings. This is the year of stewardship, Colin. I have been given the strength, thank you, God, and I have the endurance to see all areas through to a peaceful culmination for your name's sake. This is the year to start it all. It may take another 3 or 5 years to complete, but you can rest assured it has been started already in my heart and will be completed. Each completion frees you to move on to realms of your choice. Godspeed and eternal blessings, Colin. I love you soul to soul. Always, Chandra. May this covenant, this pledge, this flame of stewardship, an eternal flame, be my guide to keep me on track to this written and stated intention. May love suffuse the intention, and may this burn unspoken within. I am filled with gratitude.
Thank you for listening, and join us on October 21st for the next episode of The Creatively Engaging.